Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. We're back to normal with my co-host, Burl Love. We very much appreciate Keith Pandolfi filling in last week, and we had a great time talking to Buddy LaRosa. But Burl, I missed you.
It's funny you said back to normal, because that's not usually an adjective used to describe me, but
or
I'll
me.
Take it. I will take it. Back to the normal
routine.
Yes, here we are. And what a great chat with Buddy LaRosa.
Yeah, we had a really good time. I mean, it's like sitting with Cincinnati history. It's like there with it.
Like an icon, you know? I mean, there's probably kids that go to LaRosa's and don't realize it's a real person. You know,
that's
it's
true.
Just, yeah.
We did have LaRosa's for dinner that night.
Oh, well.
you
had to.
It was like suggestive. Today's guest, we're going to be a little bit more serious, but I'm excited to welcome Dr. Steve Davis. He is the CEO and president of Children's Hospital. They're reveling in the midst of their number one ranking of U.S. News and World Report children's hospitals, which is a very, very big deal for this region.
Yeah, the number one children's hospital in the country. Not too surprising. They're very high on the list every year when U.S. News and World Report comes out. But this was a big deal when it came out last summer. It wasn't just a celebration for the hospital. It was, I think, a moment of pride for the entire community.
Yes. So we're going to talk about all things Cincinnati Children's with him.
Well, that'll be a great conversation. Looking forward to that. Sad news this week.
Was just the worst. Hamilton County Auditor Bridget Kelly died this week. She was a guest on the podcast in October, and we had known then that she was sick, and she had talked about she had esophageal cancer. It's what she died of. And she talked to us about it, and it was just a really great conversation. And, you know, she was such a positive person, which is really what everyone is saying. It's the outpouring of love for her is incredible. And even though she needed to do it remotely, and she talked about how tough the treatment was, it's almost like I just, perhaps because she was so young, age 40, that I just, in my heart, was always like, oh, she'll be getting better from it. You never would guess when you talked to her. We were in the middle of this big six-year assessment. Scott Wortman talked to her all the time. I had a couple occasions to talk to her like fairly recently, and you never would have guessed. So the news hit really hard.
It hit a lot of people hard, and it was rather quick from the moment she resigned, turned in her letter of resignation.
Two weeks ago.
And everybody knew how serious it was because, you know, she wanted to do nothing but her job and to serve the community. A lifelong commitment to public service, starting as one of the youngest, if not the youngest, city council members for the city of Norwood.
Yes. Yes. Right. She ran right after college. It was really impressive.
Following in the footsteps of her family. I've been around long enough where I'm on the second generation of interviewing Kelly's, her father, when I was covering the city of Norwood way back in the day, was the city solicitor. That's the top legal job. And the city was making national headlines because it had sued General Motors after General Motors shut down their massive production facility in Norwood, which was a big economic blow. And the city's position was that corporations, companies that have such an economic presence in any given municipality shouldn't be able to just shut down like that. Now, of course, they lost that lawsuit, but it did make a statement. And that's when I got to meet Bob Kelly. And then, you know, flash forward, I don't want to say how many years, and we're interviewing Hamilton County Auditor Bridget Kelly in a very, timely moment when many people were getting their property tax assessments. And she explained that and, just very accessible. And unlike her father, who was known sometimes for being a little prickly is how it's described. She had in this era of political divisiveness, she was able to navigate her roles, various roles, and maintain respect and maintain her own voice and stick true to her principles, regardless of where the pressure was coming from the left or the right. She was a Democrat. But as soon as the news came out of her death, many people from both sides of the aisle were saying things along those lines, that she was just carried herself a little better than a lot of local politicians do.
I've been saying this a lot to anyone who knows me, and I wish I didn't have to say this first part, which is the things that are said publicly are not always what's said behind the scenes about somebody. I wish it was not the case, but that's something that's the thing, but not with her. And not just now, always. She's the most amazing person. She'll help you. What do you need? We love her. She's committed. And then that is really what we're hearing, you know, in all the tributes to her. And it just matches up for her. And that's just not always the case.
Well, there are a lot of people who immediately started posting tributes that included the color Kelly Green, which was her signature.
I know. The green heart is my first emoji. You know what, you guys? You could tell a little bit about what's going on in your life, whatever your first emoji is.
Well, it is a touching tribute. And I know that as we record this on a Friday, the funeral is planned for next week. And there will be a lot of
people. The visitation is April 3rd from 4 to 8. April 4th, there is a mass. I believe it's in the morning. And of course, one of the, what they're asking is that everyone wear Kelly Green.
There will be a lot of Kelly Green.
I don't even think they maybe need it. I guess you would need to ask because you would think etiquette would demand black. But I think everyone would have gone into their closets that day and been like, that's not what I would want. It's not what she would want to wear. And so they're like specifically asked that everyone wear the green.
All right. Well, again, sad news, but, you know, an opportunity to reflect on someone who did a lot of good in this community. All right. Speaking of doing good in this community.
Perfect segue.
I try, Sherry. I try. Let's bring on our guest.
Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm so excited to welcome someone who's very important to our community, Dr. Davis. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I think that you're the type of guest that we have that it's your institution that's beloved by people and people talk about it and have had experiences and touch all of the different aspects of your work, but they wouldn't say, hey, Dr. Davis, how are you doing? And you're not a household name, but your institution certainly is. And so I'm excited to get to know you better and really introduce you to all our listeners.
It is phenomenal being at Cincinnati Children's. Everywhere I go, when I have logo wear on, people stop and ask me about it, and then they tell me their story. Either they were a patient there, their parent works there, their child works there. And I've never worked at a place where routinely everywhere I go, people are excited to talk to me about.
I have followed up people asking who the guest is this week with our own personal Coolidge story. And so that's very true of like a time when we were in Children's Hospital and how and what that meant to us as a family. It's just like a story I tell after I say who the guest was going to be.
Well, people understand the institution of Cincinnati Children's. And like Sherry said, we hope to get to know you a little bit more as the president and CEO. You've been at your post not too long, but you've been with the hospital as the chief operating officer under Michael Fisher and took over for him. What has that transition like being from being the, you know, kind of the number two guy, not out, you know, really community facing, kind of the guy that keeps the trains running on time, to being the, you know, the place where the buck stops?
Well, I was very fortunate that Michael had a very good transition plan in mind. Now, the board chooses the CEO, but Michael had been preparing me for what might come. And so the transition wasn't as difficult as it might be. For example, if I had come from the outside the way I did 8.5 years ago to be the chief operating officer, I think that would have been a much more difficult transition. But Michael really put me in a great position. And then he's been available to me, as you might expect if you know him. Michael's always been available to me since then. So it's not
I think in an official capacity, executive consultant or something like that, or senior advisor?
Yeah, he was in that role for about a year.
Okay.
And he is still someone that I talk to whenever I either need advice or some history about the organization or the city. If you know Michael, he knows every person in town.
Right.
He does. This is true. I still call former City Hall reporters to be like, you remember this? What about this?
Well, one difference between you and Michael Fisher is that he was not an MD. So now the CEO of Cincinnati Children's is also a doctor. How do you think that changes your approach?
You know, there are some differences, but the key thing is that Michael, myself, Jim Anderson before him are absolutely passionate about making things better for kids. There are some advantages to being a physician. I've worked in hospitals continuously since 1985. On the other hand, it's a lot of work to get to know the business side of the organization. And we're about a $3.5 billion a year business. So it's taken a lot of work to get to know that side of the hospital, the same way probably Michael and Jim Anderson needed to spend time getting to know the clinical side.
So you've touched on something I was very curious to ask you about, is at what point in your career did you start gravitating towards the business side?
So, interesting story. When I came out of my critical care fellowship, it was during the Clinton administration when there was a lot of healthcare reform talk and people were anxious and not wanting to get into the business aspects of it if you were a physician. So I chose to go to the Cleveland Clinic out of my fellowship specifically because they were so well run that I thought I would never have to worry myself with the administrative side of things. And over my first few years there, I ended up getting involved because I'm by nature a fixer. So I'm not a complainer. If I see things that aren't working, I just go ahead and try to make them better. And because of that, I started getting involved in more and more projects. And the clinic was very good at what I would call rewarding the winner. And so if I got things done well, it led to more opportunities. And several years in, I started realizing I am doing all kinds of big projects involved with, I'm sitting at the table with financial analysts and business people and lawyers, and I feel underprepared. So I went back to school and I got a master's of medical management. And somewhere through that process, I started realizing I have an ability at this, and I thought I would hate it if you had asked me coming out of training, would I want to do this? And I started realizing I have the chance to have more of an impact than I do at the bedside. As an ICU doctor, I believe that I helped save many lives, but it was one child at a time. When I got into the business aspect of it and really have a passion for making the hospital as good as it can possibly be, I feel like I have the chance to impact thousands of patients as opposed to the one at a time. So it was a gradual process, but if you had asked me in 1995, would I be where I am today, I would have laughed and said, not a chance.
Under your tutelage, but I'm sure leading up to where we came in last June when they said that we are the number one children's hospital in the country, U.S. News and World Report. Like I consider that one of the biggest announcements in my whole time at the Inquirer, even though in the day it seemed like big news. But when I look back about the important milestones of our whole community, that certainly is one of them. And I feel like everything kind of led us to that point. What was that like?
It was one of the most exciting moments of my career. And the way it works is you get notified around midnight. And why they let you know at that point in time, I don't know. But the night that the news was to come out, I was sitting awake saying, we've got to be in the top three hopefully number two. And I think we have a chance at number one, but I didn't want to get my hopes up.
Like that, midnight before the announcement.
Yeah. So they let you know at midnight. And our team got the call. And then our chief operating officer, who replaced me, called me a little after midnight. And I remember sitting there thinking that was the longest half hour of waiting because it didn't happen exactly at midnight. But it was pretty exciting. And then
set the scene. Where were you? Were you in like a hospital conference room? Were you
no,
at home?
I was at home.
Midnight at home. He was... What, laying in bed, staring at the ceiling, pacing the floor?
No, I was down in the basement, so I didn't wake up the rest of the family where we have a nice space. But it was such a big event that now the news is embargoed for about a month before you can let anyone know for a variety
of
reasons.
That's a big secret to keep for a month.
It is. And
especially
it's not,
from us.
And it is not the best kept secret in the world. But the reason is that they want to go double and triple check. So when organizations get their rankings, if they dropped and they want to question it, they will go back to the U.S. News and ask them to take a look. So it's about a month. And then we're allowed to let people know. And again, it's at midnight, we're allowed to let people know. So we took our entire executive team into the hospital at midnight, and we let the night shift know first because we felt like they're usually the last to know things. And since we were able to know at midnight and we'd been keeping that secret for a month, let's go in the hospital and surprise the night shift people. And the looks on their face when they saw us, you know, the initial reaction seeing us at midnight is, what's wrong? And then when we started telling them the news, they were just jumping up in the air and hugging each other. And it was one of the best moments that I've had in my career.
What has it been like over the last year? Is there, do you feel like this extra pressure to keep it? Or do you feel like you're just trying to provide good service? Because I just write stories. Like, I don't write stories to win awards. I write stories to inform the community every day. And then, like, later, like, I hope that it rises to that level. But it's a daily thing that I'm trying to do.
Yeah. Well, we are fortunate. A couple of decades ago, one of our board chairs, Lee Carter, pushed us to think about being the best at getting better. And you'll hear that phrase at Cincinnati Children's all the time. We never say we're the best, but we do think we're the best at getting better. So the way we got to number one is that we've never been satisfied with any of our results. We take a little while to celebrate, but then we start looking, where can we be better next year? And it's really easy to do that in healthcare because as good as we are, not every child gets perfect care. And, you know, I have four kids, and if when I bring them into the hospital, I want things to be perfect. I have two grandchildren. They've been in the hospital more times than I would like. I want their care to be perfect. So we focus always on being better. And so when we got the number one ranking, we certainly celebrated. We had a lot of fun with it. And then we got down to, we still weren't as good as we need to be. How can we be better next year than we were last year? And how can we be better 5 years from now? And there'll always be challenges that we can't solve. And so we'll never stop focusing on being better.
What were some of the things over the past couple of years that you did focus on in terms of improvement?
You know, the pandemic actually helped us focus because what happened during the pandemic is all kinds of things were coming at us in healthcare and things that there was no playbook for. And there was no one we could call and say, well, what did you do when this happened? So we had to actually use the talent we had in the organization. And when there were challenges, we had to go to the experts closest to that work. And we had to let go as a senior leadership team and say, okay, you live in this space, you understand what it's like. Think about the masking and temperature taking that had to happen at the doors. Well, I've never worked at an entrance like that. I'm not good at the logistics. So we let all of the people who work in all the different areas get more involved. And what we found is they were more engaged. They felt empowered. They made great decisions. And we came out of the pandemic better than we were going in. And I don't know of many other organizations that can say that. then the challenge for me and the rest of the executives was, once the crisis was over, the natural human tendency is to want to pull back that control and make all the decisions. And we said, no, these people did great when things were at their worst. We've got to let them continue. And that approach allowed us to improve faster at a time when other places were really still reeling from the challenge. And that's probably one of the two most important reasons why we got to number one.
So you're touching on a little bit of a management philosophy or a leadership philosophy there. Can you tease that out a little bit? What is your personal philosophy when it comes to leadership, especially with an organization so large? I mean, you're the second largest employer in Cincinnati, number two to Kroger, and three and four and five are, you know, far below the
number one health system, 19,000 employees.
Yeah, nearly 19,000 employees. You must have some leadership philosophy that is working to keep that large of an organization moving forward. What is it?
So there are a couple things. And I will tell you, as a pediatric critical care physician, that is the perfect training for a leadership role. And I'll try not to go too deep into it. But when you're in the intensive care unit, the patients are at their sickest. You've never seen them before. You don't know them. Many of them have been seen by other doctors. They may have cancer. They may have kidney disease. They may have cardiac disease. And you're not the expert on any one of those things. And yet you have to put together a complex plan where you listen to what the cardiologist says, what the nephrologist says, what the pharmacist says, what the nurse wants to do, what the respiratory therapist wants to do, all of whom are better at their jobs than you are. And yet you have to take over the overall plan and listen to your people and know when they're right and when you have to actually go a different direction. And in the ICU, you often don't have all the information you would like. So you get used to making decisions quickly without a full set of information, and you learn to trust your team, and you know that the best team wins. And so I've carried that philosophy into every job and project and work that I've ever done, is that I'm never going to know enough to go it alone. I've got to rely on the rest of the team. And I'm pretty good at finding talent, encouraging and empowering talent, and then helping others understand that if they collaborate, they'll be better. Now, we've grown a lot. When I came in September of 15, I think we had 12,500, and we're over 19,000. So in that time period, we've grown almost 7,000 employees. One of the ways that we make sure that the culture stays strong is that every Monday morning, we have the new employees come together for their orientation, the ones who are starting, and they always start on a Monday. And I meet every new employee and I talk to them about what it means to be an employee at Cincinnati Children's, what's expected of them, and then I answer whatever questions they have. And it is probably my most favorite time every week. And at first I thought it was going to be a chore. I knew I should do it. I decided to do it. And I just love talking to them, and I usually ask them, why did they choose Cincinnati Children's to come work for us? And it's just, for me, an invigorating time, but it's important for them to hear directly at the very first part of their first day at Cincinnati Children's what it means to be an employee there.
One of my favorite things that I've seen this week, and I feel like I'm going to call it a viral video because it was on LinkedIn, as it had like hundreds of thousands of views, was the match to Cincinnati Children's, like the residents like matching
yes
to their choice. And like, I was crying. It was so
Sherry, you,
emotional.
You cry,
I'm not
you
crying
cry
a while.
You
I'm
cry
not
at dog food commercials. Let's be honest.
But it was really emotional to see that this was going to be the future of our city, and these people were going to come here to save lives.
Yes.
And how excited they were. But
they
that's
were
a big deal
for joy
to get so many matches, is it not?
Yeah. So we did extremely well in the matches, we often do. And it is a very challenging time for pediatrics right now. Fortunately, not for us at the moment, but
challenging in what way?
Well, the match is all of the programs that have residents. submit names of who, how they're ranking all the people that interview them. And the medical students submit their order of, I want to go to Cincinnati Children's first, Boston Children's second, and then they get matched. Well, every year, fewer and fewer people are choosing to go into pediatrics. And so there's a national shortage of pediatricians and pediatric subspecialists that is frightening. Now, places like us and some of the other big children's hospitals still do well, but the smaller places are not filling. And a big part of that is that medical students come out these days on average owing about $250,000. And when you look at the profession of medicine and you look at the 20 lowest paid jobs for physicians, 15 of them are in pediatrics. So if you owe a lot of money, that is a lot of pressure when you're deciding what field do I go into. And that's, unless that changes in the future, there will be a shortage of pediatricians that will be difficult to fix.
Is that nationwide?
Yeah, that's nationwide. In Cincinnati, we are blessed. You know, we have excellent pediatricians throughout the region, some who work for us, some who work for other systems, and some who are still in private practices.
I do feel like then once they're here, then we got them. This is such a great place to live.
Well, and I think it goes without saying that Cincinnati Children's has created a destination for people who want to get into pediatric care.
You know, I think Cincinnati Children's has always been a great place to go to, but the prominence of the city has come up quite a bit during that last several years. And in fact, I got more calls about the Bengals and the Bearcats being in the playoffs 2 years ago than I have at any point in my career. My friends from all over the country were saying, what's going on in Cincinnati? And I said, I've told you, it's a great place to live. We used to have to convince people to come take a look. And then once they came, they're like, oh, this is fantastic. And not just the Cincinnati Children's, but the city itself. I think in the last few years, life on the East and West Coast is probably getting more and more challenging. And we are not finding much difficulty at all recruiting from the coast. And as I mentioned, I meet the new employees and I ask them where they're coming from. And sometimes there are several from California or Colorado or New York or New Jersey. And they say they want to work at the number one children's hospital. And then they say, and we took a look at Cincinnati and we can afford a house and the commute is not bad. You know, if you've lived here your whole life, you might think the traffic's bad. But I grew up in Boston. It takes me 13 minutes to get to work in the morning. Can't beat it.
When I moved back from D.C. and I heard people complaining about traffic here, I had the same reaction to you. So that's a good point to jump back into the Steve Davis story. So you're from Boston. Mm-hmm. That's where you grew up?
Yes, and I was at Game 6 of the 1975 World Series.
Oh!
It was probably still the best World Series ever, even though the Red Sox lost to the Big Red Machine.
Is that the Carlton Fisk waving the, yeah. That's a classic game.
Oh, we love baseball on this podcast. And by we, I mean Burl. So that's this is good.
So have you
been
here?
I'll be at opening day on Thursday, and I'm hoping it's a nice warm day.
I think it's going to be a sunny day. I don't think it's going to be super warm, but kind of like a repeat of yesterday, I'm hoping as well. So have your baseball allegiances changed?
You
are being, you know, recorded right now, so be careful.
Well, I will honestly tell you, I root for where I live and I root for the Boston teams because I grew up going to games with my dad. So I will always root for the Red Sox, the Celtics, the Bruins and the Patriots. But I root for the Bengals and I root for the Bearcats and I root for the Reds. And I'm a huge fan of the soccer team FC. I have to admit, I used to live in Pittsburgh, so I did root for the Steelers, and I used to live in Baltimore. I've never rooted for the Ravens, though.
That's good.
Because I was in Cleveland when the Browns moved to Baltimore, so I hate the Ravens.
I was in Cleveland, and I covered the very last game before they left as like a reporter, like writing about the fan experience of that day. And then I made trips with the all of the fans to the end, to the commissioner, and fighting to keep the team. And that was part of my job as the night police reporter at the Lorain Morning Journal. So I was there too.
So what led you to a career in medicine and healthcare?
Not your family business, right? What was your family business?
So my family owned an Italian restaurant for 55 years. My uncle was the principal owner. My sisters worked there for decades. I worked there. All of my cousins and aunts worked there. But I was always good at math and science, and my mom and dad did not have the opportunity to go to college. My dad joined the Marine Corps at 16 during the middle of World War II because that was the thing to do. And my mom was an immigrant child in the 40s, and girls didn't go to college very often in those days. So from the first I can remember, I had my parents telling me, you're going to be the first in the family to go to college.
And you're not going to work in the restaurant your whole life.
Yeah. Oh, there was no chance of that. That was just to have spending money when I got to college. And when I was in college, I wanted to combine my love of science with working with people. And at the time, it seemed like healthcare was the absolute perfect mix of needing to know science and technology, but also connecting with people. And I think it's even more important now than ever.
So I don't hear any Boston or very little in your voice. Was that a deliberate part, or have you just not lived there long enough?
I moved out, freshman year of college in 1980. And other than short periods of time, I'm not there for very long. If I'm home for a week, I sound like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck in Good Will Hunting.
Okay.
Sherry and I have a common friend who's lived here forever, and she's from Boston, and she sounds like she just got off the plane. So it's definitely
in the best way.
In the best way. Was there anything people describe? The call to be a physician is a calling. Was there a moment in your life where you felt very strongly about that decision?
There have been several. Probably the one that when I was in medical school and I was doing rotations doing obstetrics and surgery and gynecology and pediatrics, I happened to do a rotation at Pittsburgh Children's, and I saw a child who, this was probably 1986, who had a critical illness. Nobody knew what it was. He had been at two other hospitals. And I saw a team of physicians come together and work tirelessly for a couple of weeks until they finally figured out what this child had. And while the child didn't do extremely well early on, ended up surviving and then thriving. And it was that moment that I said, I want to work in pediatrics, because I had never seen the teamwork that I saw those pediatricians do when I was working on the adult side. And it just became easier and easier for me, because I realized kids never really cause their own problems. And I had done rotations where I had taken care of adults who had been smoking three packs of cigarettes a day or doing other things that weren't in their best interests. And yet I saw parents who might not take care of themselves be willing to do almost anything for their kids. And it made it easy for me to decide I want to go into pediatrics, because I can help a child become a healthy adult. And there's no better way to have a healthy adult than start out with healthy kids. And in most parents, you have allies. Frequently for adult patients, you don't have that same kind of ally that you do with a parent.
Meaning the parents themselves being the allies and part of the...
Oh, parents are fierce advocates for their children in ways that many adults don't have that when they're in the hospital. And, you know, one of the reasons we work so closely with the parents is because, one, they are the expert on their child, and two, they won't let anything go. And that's the way they should be. They're involved in their care. And when we transition them home, that's who's going to be taking care of them. So that partnership with parents is something that makes pediatrics different and, for me, better.
I mean, I think advocate even more than people do for themselves. Something I've been writing about this week and how difficult that you, as an adult, you're like, oh, well, I'll listen to the doctors. But I think when you're talking about your child, you're like, no, this. And it's just that bond does make you better, even than for yourself.
So we talked with Mark Clemens, who has your job for TriHealth.
Yep. I had lunch with him yesterday.
All right. Did you tell him you were going to be on the podcast and ask for some tips? Did he?
No, I did not know he had been on recently.
So he talked about getting to the point where our community is less reliant on the traditional hospital setting, whether that be neighborhood clinics or other health programs. That was a big part of what he said he was trying to accomplish for TriHealth. Is there a similar, is that something that when it comes to pediatric care, you think is addressed properly in our community? The care for children before they get to the hospital?
Pediatrics has always been ahead of adult medicine in understanding the importance of prevention. When you think about what you do when you have a baby, you have a checkup at 2 weeks of age, then you have a 2 month checkup, a 4 month checkup, a 6 month checkup, 1 year, 2 years, and you get checked up for a variety of different things throughout that time course. You get your immunizations during that time period. So everything that happens in the first couple of years of life is to get you off to the best start you can be on. We talk to parents about nutrition. We talk to them about screen time. You know, not something when I first went into pediatrics that we talked very much about, because the cable and all the other outlets for media weren't there. But now it's something that it's important for us to talk to parents about, those kinds of things. And so pediatricians have always spent a great deal of time educating families on how to care for their kids and to keep them healthy. And when we look at the care that gets delivered to kids, more than 90% of it happens outside the hospital. I think we're going to take it into the home even more through the, now we have community health workers who visit. We have programs like Cradle Cincinnati and Every Child Succeeds that do home visits. But technology is allowing us to get into the home and do education and training and follow-up, remote patient monitoring, so that we can deliver more and more care where they live or in their community, rather than having to come down to our main campus. And, you know, down the road, we hope that the number of kids who need to come to our main campus is much smaller.
How have you had to pivot since the pandemic in terms of mental health?
Not as much as you might think, primarily because we were seeing a mental health crisis in children before the pandemic. Now, it certainly got worse, but we had seen just unrelenting growth in the number of children with mental health conditions for the last 30 years. If you were to plot it, and I know, you know, we're not on video, but it's almost a straight line up. And the pandemic did make it worse.
What we call the hockey stick?
Yeah. Now, what changed is that the pandemic allowed us to do more virtual visits, which in some cases may be better than showing up in an emergency department with a child with an anxiety issue or a panic attack, because like any emergency room, it's busy, it's chaotic, it's not exactly the calmest environment for a patient. But we were already looking at a mental health crisis long before the pandemic, and we had started our work on really trying to cure mental health a decade before the pandemic. Our board, at several key junctures over the last 30 years, has made critical decisions that have impacted our future. And one of them was to focus on mental health, even though it wasn't an aspect that we don't get paid very well for. It does not make us a substantial amount of money. It's challenging. And yet, they said, we needed to focus on that. And it's been clearly the right decision, and we try to be there for all the kids, but it is probably our biggest challenge is understanding what is happening to kids today.
At younger and younger ages.
Yeah. And, you know, the anxiety that our kids are feeling is so widespread and different than prior generations. And it's not their fault. Older generations often blame younger generations for conditions that they had nothing to do with creating them. And we do spend an enormous amount of time and effort trying to understand the needs of the community and how to prevent more and more children from having mental health issues. So we started several years ago putting behavioral health specialists in primary care practices. Primary care practices are often a place that parents trust. They go there many times with their child, and it's different going to see a behavioral health specialist in that setting with a trusted partner, and you can see them long before it's a problem. We're also in many of the local schools. We really don't want to wait until they show up in our emergency department or in our psychiatrist's office. So we're putting more and more effort to see children early on, to help parents with kids who are having anxiety issues early on, to work with schools to help identify children who might be at risk so that we can start helping them while it's a small problem rather than when they're in the emergency department on a Friday night unable to cope.
So if we have listeners who are thinking about a young person, whether their own children or someone that they know, what is your advice if they fear that the child needs has a mental health issue that's not being addressed? Like, where do they start before it gets to a point where they're in the ER?
Yeah, they really should start with their pediatrician. They have a trusted, most people in the area have a pediatrician that they go to, or a family practice doctor, or a trusted advisor, and start there and try to get them help early on. If you're thinking that they might have an issue, they probably do. One of the biggest improvements we've seen is that the stigma around mental health, while still there, is nothing like it used to be. It used to be you would never hear about it, and it wasn't that they weren't having issues, it's that nobody wanted to admit to it. And now people are much more open about it, and I think a lot of the professional athletes and celebrities and others who've come out and talked openly about their own mental health issues have made it easier for young people, and particularly teenagers, to admit they might need help. And so I would say start there, and then most of the pediatricians' offices are actually now pretty good at handling a lot of the early issues around mental health issues. Certainly, it wasn't part of my training 35 years ago, but the pediatricians today have, they know it's such a problem. They've educated themselves and they provide good resources. And then when it's not working, they know when to refer them and where to refer them to.
So Cincinnati Children's also is really helping the city address the violence issue with our teenagers and the uptick we have seen in violence. Can you talk a little bit about that's how the hospital can address this? Because we're so used to like the police department addressing it and it seeming like they just need to solve the problem themselves. But it seems like we're really in a moment of like wraparound services.
Yeah. You know, like many things, we've realized that the issues that are impacting our community can't be solved by any one group or individual. We need to come together. And one of the things that we've focused on the last few years is understanding that we are a trusted brand in the city and that we have good relationships with the police department, with the mayor, with local politicians, with the schools, with businesses. And so we're able to convene others to help provide those kinds of wraparound services. And no one can do it alone at all. And, you know, we had a demonstration just a couple of weeks ago at our board retreat of what our pediatricians are doing around gun safety in the homes and how to educate families. And we don't try to talk people out of having a gun in the home. That is usually not a winning discussion. But we do talk to them at their visits, well, child visits. If you have a gun in the home, how are you storing it? Here are some options. And then we try to make it easy for them to have a gun locker and to make sure that kids are safe. That's something that years ago pediatricians may not have thought was their job. But our job is actually to keep kids well, and they need to understand that there's more gun violence than any of us would like, and we need to make sure that children aren't accidentally harmed. So our pediatricians have those kinds of conversations, and they've created an excellent simulation training for pediatricians, because it's often an uncomfortable kind of discussion because it's become such a political issue over the years. So we train our residents and fellows and others in the community on how to have those difficult conversations. The same way we've trained them to work with families that have vaccine hesitancy. You know, we're seeing a real challenge with the recurrence of measles. There are more cases of measles in 2024 by March 15th than all of 2023.
We've had two alerts that I can think of off the top of my head, the exposure at the airport and exposure at Disney on Ice. And as a mother, I wasn't at Disney on Ice, but I was like, oh no, all those little kids. And you may not have had to have, you might have already had to have had it, but you might not have been able to have all of those shots yet.
Yeah, and there's so much misinformation out there. We do think it's absolutely vital that we do the best job we possibly can in providing parents, families, and the communities with accurate information around vaccines and what happens when children aren't vaccinated. And we have, you know, almost 100-year history on vaccine research, and we are probably the leading children's hospital in the world when it comes to vaccine development, testing, and administration, dating back to Albert Sabin with the poliovirus vaccine, and then part of the rotavirus vaccine, the RSV vaccine, and the COVID vaccine. We were involved in all of those. So we think it's critical that we educate people on who are vaccine hesitant.
Are you making some inroads, or is that hesitancy kind of stagnant and still just persisting?
I think we've made progress on how to approach families with that, rather than just getting into an argument, providing them the information that they need. And oftentimes, like most things, when there are disagreements, is that you're not listening. And so we actually do more listening than we used to, and ask them, you know, where are you getting your information? What are you hearing about? Where are you getting it? And then providing them with other sources. And most importantly, don't make them feel like they're not doing the best for their child. Because even though I believe every child should be vaccinated, parents who are vaccine hesitant are still trying to do their best for their child. And so getting into arguments with them isn't a helpful thing. Providing good information in a way that they can hear it and internalize it, and then be there for them when they have questions and concerns, and do it in a non-judgmental way, we've made some inroads.
Well, as we wrap up here, congratulations again on being ranked the number one children's hospital system in the nation by U.S. News and World Report. Do you feel pressure to maintain that ranking? Do you worry about things like that?
Not in the least. We don't worry about the rankings. We do worry about the fact that not every kid gets perfect care, and every child deserves it. So every single day, we start our meetings with safety briefings, and we have a daily operations brief every morning where we get together with people from every one of our sites, and we understand the potential risks for that day and what are we doing to mitigate those risks. And until we've eliminated all challenges for kids, we will continue to focus on how are we going to be better today than we were yesterday. The rankings will come with that. We've been in the top three for 15 years. And it's not by focusing on the rankings. It's by focusing on trying to deliver the best care that we can and knowing that we may have made mistakes. So what are we going to do now to mitigate those mistakes and prevent them from happening to the next patient?
I think I can't think of a better way to end our conversation today. I want to thank you for your time. I know you're a busy person. We talked about the size of the operation you run and the importance of it, and how you know, there's no time for you to rest because of the needs of families and children always evolving.
I did hear a fact about you.
Uh-oh.
I think that is interesting.
You saved it for the end?
Okay. You hear about this, but there is a segue here.
All right.
That you do hear this sometimes about leaders, and it's just something innate, that you don't need a lot of sleep. Is that true?
I think it's genetic. I don't sleep much. My father didn't sleep much, and my grandfather didn't sleep much. And the other thing that I don't actually need is a break from work. And in fact, if you were to ask me what I do to recharge my batteries, it's to walk around the hospital and talk to families. And when I hear about the challenges that they have, and then when I hear about what Cincinnati Children's has done for them, I go back to my office full of energy again.
All right. Well, we thank you for your time today. And we also hope that if there's any big news coming from Cincinnati Children's Hospital, that you and our former colleague, Barrett, who's with you today, your communications person, that you tell us first. We like breaking news, Barrett. And again, thank you for your time.
Well, I feel like the biggest takeaway is that we could all have the motto of Children's Hospital. We need to be the best at being better.
Being the best at getting better. Yeah.
Really, that is such a telling thing. Celebrate and then concentrate on what tomorrow really looks like. And I am a big believer in that.
Well, I am too, Sherry, but it is, for me, inspiring and even humbling to see someone so focused in on that message, you know, and I think that's why you see the success at Cincinnati Children's. There are a lot of people lining up behind him. He's got a lot of support. So it'll be, I think, a not too uncommon occurrence for them to get that national ranking.
I think that we can do a two-peat for sure here.
All right. Well, here we are, the day as we record, the day after opening day. How
yes.
are you feeling, Sherry? A little tired? Did you need a day to recover? I know I do.
I don't have that day to recover, but I I feel like somebody beat me up. I'm not, you guys, I barely drank. I'm not a big drinker, and I'm not hungover. But the crush of the people, yay. And that is how it should be. I woke up this morning. I cracked half a nail off, and it's very painful. I have a huge gouge on my shin and the biggest bruise I've seen.
I don't know where you were partying, but I didn't get trampled like that. So
the banks.
I think
was,
I just made up a word, by the way.
Banks
trampled.
Yeah. Was body. It was a beautiful day.
Yeah. So everybody by now knows, you know, it was a beautiful blue sky day. If you were in the sunshine, it was actually pleasant and warm. If you were in the shade, you might be a little chilly. But compared to other opening days that I've been to where it's been snowing and people had hand warmers,
you never know.
It was perfect day. The Reds won. You know, they have high expectations again this year.
Were you in the best mood with the win?
Oh, I was completely in the best mood.
The cheering. It was full. It was really.
No, it was a big day. And, you know, the Enquirer participated in the opening day parade. So that was fun.
Oh, I had the best time. I had the best time, like, seeing everybody along the route and just remembering how diverse our community is and how much fun we can be. And that was great to see everybody from a different perspective.
One of the things that, so I had friends visiting from out of town who I met when I worked in DC. So they were Nats fans. So they were excited to come.
Wah, wah.
I know. Well, I'm mad for them. But they had both heard about how amazing opening day is here. But until they saw it, they didn't get it. It, you know, everywhere we went, it was packed. It was fun. People were kind and nice, even though my friend Jason was wearing his Nats t-shirt and his Nats hat. And I was like, dude, please don't stand too close to me. But he actually found some fellow Nats fans.
Easy trip from there.
But no, you know, it's just one of those days that reminds me how important tradition is here and how we have respect for our past while we look to the future. Not just because, you know, we're in the whatever 100th year of the opening day parade, but also the honorary Grand Marshal, Jim Scott, longtime radio personality.
Yeah, it's good to see him.
Whose health is a challenge for him right now. Was in the parade, like so many parades beforehand, that the community was so happy to see him. You know, the actual Grand Marshals were two players from the 99 season where the Reds, I'll say they went into the playoffs. They had that one game playoff in. But we interviewed on this podcast, Dimitri Young and then Pokey Reese. So fans were just thrilled to see them. And then the mayor, Sean Casey, throwing out the first pitch.
You're going to say the actual mayor. Well, that's what happens when you cover City Hall.
No, the mayor in air quotes. You know, Sean Casey, first baseman, played for the Reds in that era as well. Beloved in this town, and he loves Cincinnati. He threw a pretty good first pitch compared to one of our real mayors in the past, who is nationally known now for one of the...
He has a sense of humor about
for
that.
For one of the... I don't even know what the right word is.
Let's just say...
Noteworthy opening day pitches, Mark Mallory. You can find it, of course, on YouTube. But yeah, it's just a day where, you know, baseball is about spring and new beginnings, and you feel that here. But we also love to honor our traditions and our past, and seeing Jim Scott, people reaching out to him, and then how thrilled people were to see Sean Casey and Dimitri Young and Pokey Reese. Marty Brenneman was honored because this year would mark the 50 years when he debuted as the Reds play-by-play announcer.
So
he was the honorary captain and got to walk out with... he got to walk out with, the other players at the beginning of the games. At the beginning of the game,
I was in my seat for the beginning, and then I left my seat.
Well, I
missed some of the rest.
Yeah, you are definitely there, Sherry. I bet you didn't see much of the game because you have, you know, hands to shake and babies to kiss and all of those things. But I was,
because you couldn't get a text in or out like during the day at the banks. Once you were in the stadium, then things were, you're up and running again.
Yeah,
I organized like I had a big group chat. I'm like, we're everyone's section, and we went section to section and picked everyone up. Did a big walk around.
Oh, that's everybody. Fun. That is fun. That is really fun. Yeah, there's so many people that I know were at the game because I saw their social media posts, including my brother, who I never connected with, and other people like that. So.
I haven't posted yet. That seems like a bridge too far today.
Oh yeah. Well, anyway, everybody needs to recover. I was telling producer Phil before we started recording that it looks like the whole city's recovering because Friday's usually a slower day around downtown. It's really slow out there today.
Yeah, it is.
Like the highways coming into downtown were wide open.
I know a lot of people golfing today.
They're
not doing that downtown.
No, that is true. Well, Reds season is officially underway as we record right now.
No one's calling me back.
Oh, yeah. Nobody's
doing it. I got to write some stories, people.
It's a good day to catch up on work. It's a good day to, get reset for the week ahead. But, yeah, baseball's back. I couldn't be happier. You know, the Reds, as we record, are in first place. And...
seems like a couple
stats I would like to throw your way. One is that Ellie De La Cruz is on pace to steal 162 bases this year.
You know what the most impressive thing about him
What's
is?
That?
The interview in English.
That is phenomenal
he is DeWanting, spending that time, and the reason why He doesn't want an interpreter. He wants to connect with, he wants to be able to hear what they're saying and them to know exactly what he's saying. I was like, he's so young. Yeah. I'd like to have that greater understanding of that communication. I was like, wow.
One of the youngest.
That was a big, to me.
Youngest players to start
yeah.
an opening day game. The other stat is that Nick Martini is on pace to hit, let me do my math real quick here, like 370 home runs.
Who doesn't want a Martini jersey? I'm just putting that out there. Like, I feel like I haven't bought a jersey in a while.
Home runs on opening day. You have to go back to Adam Dunn.
I was happy for him. That was a good day.
Until someone else, hit that landmark. So it was just a great day.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a long season, though, so buckle up.
I know. Jason Williams wrote that today, but I'm the eternal optimist. Well,
I mean, yeah, Debbie Downer, long season. Don't get too excited.
He was excited, though. He was tempered. He was excited.
I know, but that's his shtick, man. Yeah. He has to keep it real.
That's his job.
That is his job. All right. Well, should we wrap this up?
We should. Thank you for listening to That's So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Inquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati is sponsored once again by Cincinnati.com, the online home of The Enquirer. If you'd like to sponsor an episode listened to by thousands each week, email me personally at elove@cincinnati.com.
That's So Cincinnati was produced today by Phil Didion. Lisa Gillespie books our guests. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and share us with a friend.
And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Enquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of Cincinnati.com. And remember, just hit the ball and touch them all a moment in the sun. It's gone and you can kiss that one goodbye.